You're listening to The Tales We Tell, a podcast about spooky stories, unsolved mysteries, and local lore. I'm your host, Hannah Parch.
And I'm Katie.
Welcome back!
It feels like it's been a while, but it's only been a week and one day.
A week and one day. We're not completely off of our
routine,
which I did make a little announcement on Instagram yesterday for everyone to know.
Also, you should go ahead and take that picture down. I saw somewhere that they're saying you shouldn't be posting pictures of your vaccine card.
Oh,
yeah. Why? I didn't look into the reason why. I literally kind of scrolled and didn't get a chance to read it, but I recommend that to you and any and all of our listeners. Don't post a photo of your card.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. I blocked out all of my identifying information.
But. Yep. But there's still, and maybe that was, like, maybe you took care of the things that they were, you know.
I don't know. It was literally just my birthday. But anyways. First of all, the reason that you didn't hear any whine at the beginning is because it's 3:50 in the afternoon. On a Friday.
And we may drink a lot, but we have, you know, some...
We have
standards.
Some dignity.
Or decency.
I'm drinking water. Katie's not drinking anything because she hates water. But rest assured...
I love water, actually. I just don't like drinking cold things when it's already really cold.
My water's like room temperature. I don't know. Anyway, I completely forgot what I was saying.
Announcement?
I was saying something else. Anyways, I don't know. The announcement. Oh, I was going to say, rest assured, we'll both be drinking later tonight.
Yeah.
Which is part of why we're not drinking now.
I'm sure they were all so worried about that.
I know. Whatever. Hopefully it's still a, like, good episode, even though we're not. Well, we're never drunk.
It will be because we're awesome and hilarious.
Okay, so the thing I wanted to announce is that I know we talked about how we're trying to be more present on social media, and I was informed by a friend who happens to also have her own marketing company that I need to get on the Reels and the TikTok. And although I've had a TikTok for a while, like since quarantine started, I've only ever just been a creeper on it. And I'm officially...
Meaning she just watches the videos.
Yeah, I just follow.
She doesn't post any content. She's not like stalking people or you know, leaving lots of creepy, weird comments.
No.
That's what she means by creeper.
Yes.
As in she just watches the videos.
Thank you
without
for clarifying.
Yeah.
But part of it was I didn't want to have to learn how to make a TikTok and like we're too old for it, really. It's a younger generation's game.
My thing is it's not an age issue so much as it is a time thing.
Yeah.
And so like to have to come up with something creative to post, either it's you're coming up with something new and original or you're getting on a TikTok trend and creating something like that. And either way, I feel like it takes a lot of time, and it takes even more time to come up with something new, and then you don't know if it's going to be a hit.
Yeah. Katie forgot to turn her phone off.
It's on silent.
Yeah, just, sure.
They're loud on silent. you spend all this time creating something, and you're like, ooh, maybe this will be like a hot new dance trend or a new funny thing on the TikTok. And then it's not.
Yeah. You're correct that it has taken me at least like 30 minutes per video just to figure out the format, but
30 minutes for a 30 second video.
Yeah. I try to do the minute long, the 60 seconds. So anyways, it's an unofficial, podcast account. So it's under my name. If you want to find us on TikTok, it's at Hannah_Parch. It should be easy. It's like the first thing we say at the beginning of the episode. But I'll be using it for like promotional things. I'm trying to start talking about the episodes on the day they come out, give you a little preview. I'm also going to do some silly things with my dog and everything. So Anyways, that's another social media you can follow us on. Also, if you don't have TikTok, if you're an elder millennial like ourselves and you don't want to download it, I will post most of those videos on our Reels on Instagram, which is...
The Tales We Tell podcast.
Thank you. Okay. Ready to jump in?
Let's do it. Story right. time.
So, this is a kind of a classic paranormal tale.
Alrighty.
I'm going to be talking about the Amityville hauntings.
I know this one.
Do you want to guess? First of all, I want to let everyone know, I had to dig deep for some of my research, because when you Google Amityville hauntings, the only thing that comes up is
the movie.
All of the movies.
Oh, that.
So my first trivia, how many movies have been made about this case?
5.
Way more than that.
God. 15.
Yes! Nice. And I will not be talking about any of them because they're all inaccurate. Sort of.
That's Hollywood for you.
Yeah.
Loosely based.
Loosely based. And just... So everyone knows, because I know this is kind of a controversial haunting. I know that there's a lot of controversy around whether it was a big hoax. I know there's a lot of controversy around Ed and Lorraine Warren, who got involved. I'm going to address all of that at the end. And we're just going to look into this as a... We're just going to go with what we've got right now.
Sit back and enjoy the story, folks.
Yeah, guys, don't nitpick at stuff. okay. So, first I'm going to start by telling you about Ronald DeFeo Jr., a.k.a. Butch DeFeo. Here is his lovely face.
He looks like a butch.
Yeah, he does. He's very
70s.
Very 70s. He's got the kind of Farrah Fawcett bangs.
Yeah, the swoopy hair.
And the beard. So, this is...
Looks a little bit like Grizzly Adams.
I don't think I know who Grizzly Adams is.
Also very... Well, yeah, I think he's 70s.
Oh, okay. Well, Butch DeFeo was the oldest... of 5 children born to Ronald and Louise DeFeo. He was born in 1961. His siblings, all younger, obviously. Dawn was 18 in 1974, which is when this takes place. Allison was 13, Mark was 12, and John Matthew was 9. So Ronald Sr. worked as a car salesman, and I think it was a family-owned business, and working there allowed him to earn enough to provide his family with a comfortable upper-middle-class lifestyle. And the family moved into a 1927 Dutch colonial home at 112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville, New York. Here's a picture of that.
Yep, definitely a colonial.
Yep, this is the classic from-the-side picture. The house is 5 bedrooms, 3.5 baths. It has a boathouse, a swimming pool, and it sits on a quarter acre lot. So it's not actually a huge piece of property. It's definitely not like a...
They've used up all of the land.
Yes.
Like with the making the house.
Yeah. You don't get much of a yard.
Yeah.
Is it sad that I was thinking about the... crap. I can't ever remember the address. What's it called?
The Boulevard?
Take a drink. Yeah, what is it? Why is it not in my notes?
8675309?
Yeah, Boulevard.
Yeah. I was like, thinking about it earlier with the when we were talking about the movies, and I was like, you know, loosely based on.
Loosely based. You could probably not split this lot into 2 lots and sell it off. Okay, so Ronald Sr., providing for his family, yada yada. He was also known to be kind of domineering and hot-tempered, and he also fought a lot with Louise and the children, but especially with Butch. And when Butch was a teenager, he started getting teased at school. And I feel like when you get bullied at school, you either, like, deal with it one of 2 ways. You either, like, introvert and become, like, what I assume... Well, I don't assume that you were bullied. I was bullied, and I turned into an introvert. Or you turn, like, outward and you take out all of your frustrations. So, Butch did the latter.
Well, also, if he's got that, like, kind of tense home life that, you know, if he's fighting a lot with his dad, a lot of times bullies are bullies because of what's going on at home.
Yeah. So, he kind of got violent, and his behavior got to a point where his family was like, we gotta send you to a psychiatrist. So they sent him to a psychiatrist. Butch never acknowledged that he needed to see a psychiatrist, so shockingly, therapy did not work for him. And so after they decided, they realized that wasn't going to work, his parents decided to incentivize good behavior by giving him lots of expensive gifts and cash. And again, shockingly, that didn't work either. And by age 17, Butch's behavior had worsened, and he was now regularly using LSD and heroin. You know, the good ones.
It's a fun combination.
So Butch is expelled from school because he's so terrible, and his dad gives him a position at the car dealership, which is, again, family-owned. So he basically just nepotizes his way into a cushy position.
Doesn't seem like working at a car dealership really fits in his disposition as kind of a jerk.
Yeah, and he doesn't really ever go to work. His dad gives him a weekly stipend regardless of job performance or attendance. And Butch just kind of goes to work when he wants to, leaves when he wants to, and uses all of his money, because he's still living at home, to buy guns, alcohol, and drugs. You know, the
trifecta. Real winner right there.
So Butch is becoming more and more violent. He, at one point, threatens a friend with a rifle while they're on a hunting trip. Why you're taking Butch DeFeo on a hunting trip with you? I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe you figure he'll get some of his aggression out by, you know, stalking and then killing an animal, and maybe he won't turn that aggression onto you.
Yeah, but hunting isn't an aggressive sport.
It's really not.
It really shouldn't be.
But I was kind of thinking of, like, that instead of the thrill of, like, being mean and, like, putting down a person.
Yeah.
Like, if you're actually hunting the animal, like, tracking them and everything, there's that, like, I'm gonna get you kind of a thing. I don't know. Like, that's, I'm not saying that's the mindset of hunters. I'm just saying that, like, that could be a mindset that he might have.
Yes. So in another instance, he tried to shoot his father point blank with a 12-gauge shotgun during an argument, but the gun malfunctioned. Again, why you're not, like, reporting that to the police immediately, I don't know, but they're still letting him live in their house.
I was going to be a question, too, is, you know, like, sure, he's been expelled from school and he's got these behavioral issues, but has he had any trouble with the law?
I don't think so. They didn't mention that up until this.
I'm sure if there was anything, Daddy got it swept under the rug pretty quickly.
Yes. And then, funny you should mention the law, because his next venture, in 1974, he planned a mock robbery of a bank, and it was all a way for him to get away with the $20,000 deposit he had been given from the car dealership. So again,
so he wasn't robbing the bank so much as he was robbing his father's business?
Yes, and he took the money to the bank, and then, like, I guess he had a friend come in and, like, fake a robbery, and then he just kept the money, and then he was like, I don't know, the deposit got stolen at the bank robbery. Which, again, why you're giving this employee who never shows up to work, who's known to be violent, who's known to be into drugs, that's not the person you send to the bank with a deposit.
And also the fact that he spends all of his money on guns, drugs, and booze, yeah. Like, you give him a lot of money, what do you think he's gonna do with it?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, sure, he doesn't seem like the kind of person to be like, well, this money's from my paycheck that I kind of earned, so I'm gonna spend it how I want.
Yeah.
But this money is not being given to me, this is not my money, so I'm not gonna spend it. Like, that's not his mindset, I would imagine.
He doesn't seem like the kind of person that has, like, a savings account. Mm-mm. Or, like, a budget.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing if, you know, sure, maybe he buys a lot of guns, drugs, and booze, but also puts money aside to save up for getting his own place.
Yeah.
Then I might be like, okay, yeah, we'll trust you with the deposit.
I still wouldn't. I'd be like, you have to consistently come to work.
Yeah, no.
So the police are called for the robbery, and they question Butch just as a witness, mm-hmm. like, hey, you were there during this. And Butch just flies off the handle, gets really defensive, really aggressive, and refused to cooperate. And his father asked him about it, like, do you know anything about this? And Butch threatened to kill him. And so his dad just dropped it. So on November 13th, 1974, at around 3 a.m., Butch took one of his guns, which was a 35 caliber rifle, went into his parents' bedroom and shot both of them in the head. After that, he went to his brother's room. Mark and John Matthew shared a room, and he shot them both.
How old were they?
12 and 9.
And how old was he at the time?
I think he was, let's see, he was born in 61, so he was, I think, 23.
Okay.
Yeah.
I figured, you know, it was probably not, you know, like around 18 or a little older.
Yeah, he was in his early 20s. So after he shoots the boys, he goes into his sister's room. Again, Dawn and Allison shared a room, and he shot them.
Have the gunshots not woken them all up at this point yet, or?
Well, there's some weird stuff about it. So, initially, well, okay, so evidence suggested later that Louise, his mom, and Allison, his 13-year-old sister, were both awake at the time of the killings. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit.
Because, I mean, that's why you start with the parents, is they're the ones who are more likely to hear the noise and wake up.
Yeah.
Versus the kids, who tend to sleep a little bit more soundly.
So, he would later claim that he had drugged everyone.
I would believe that.
And they were all found in the same position, lying face down in their beds. And they hadn't, there's no sign of struggle. They hadn't been moved. It was like they were laying that way when he shot them. But that's
weird.
They did, like, extensive toxicology reports on the bodies. And they didn't find any kind of drugs or sedatives or anything in their system. And also, no one heard anything, like, including the neighbors. The neighbors heard their dog barking at some point during the night, but they didn't hear any gunshots at all. And there were six.
And what did he? What kind of gun did he use?
It was a 35 caliber rifle.
Yeah, I think those are hard to, like,
yeah,
silence. I guess the dog heard it, and that's what the dog was barking at.
Yeah. It's very strange. Also, apologies. Am I the only one who's hearing the air, like, super loud right now in the headphones?
Only when you're quiet.
Okay. I'm just going to keep talking over it then.
Yeah.
So after Butch killed everyone, he took a shower, got dressed, and put his bloody clothes and the gun in a pillowcase, and he left for work. And was on his way to work, he dumped the pillowcase full of evidence in a storm drain, and he got to work and pretended everything was normal. He pretended that he had no idea why his dad wasn't showing up to work and called the house and was like, no one's answering the phone, I don't know. Left work around noon, because that's a normal work day.
Hey, the fact that he showed up at all was apparently impressive.
And then he spent the rest of the day with friends trying to create an alibi and making sure that he told all of his friends and everyone around him that he had been trying to get a hold of his parents or his family all day and no one was answering the phone. Around 6:30 that evening,
I don't want to say smart, but
he's not. I feel like planned it to some point.
I think he's clever.
Yeah.
But not necessarily smart.
Yeah.
Because if he was smart, he would have guilt them, really.
If he was smart, he would have taken all the money his dad's given him and move out. Go move somewhere.
Yeah. There's like, a lot of things he would have done differently if he was smart.
If someone was just giving me money, regardless of whether I went to work, I would move.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't.
Independence.
We just bought this house.
it sounds like he's clever, like,
yeah,
you know, maybe he's thought about this, you know, like, and it's premeditated, something that he's been planning and mulling over for a while, but, like, he obviously knows, like, okay, you know, clean yourself up.
Right.
So you don't have any, like, blood splatter on you.
Right.
Dispose of the bloody clothing, like, don't hide it somewhere.
Yeah, get rid of it.
Get rid of it, get rid of the weapon.
Right.
So they can't tie you to it anyway and have an alibi.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
He's not that smart, though, as I'm going to tell you.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't guess that he is, but it. I mean, he's thought of some things.
So around 6:30, he goes into a local bar and starts screaming and asking for help, and he says, "I think my parents have been shot."
That's an odd thing to say. And why would you go to a bar to say that?
I guess presumably he wants people to think he went home, found his parents, didn't look for anyone else, and just ran to the closest place that had a phone, maybe?
Did their big fancy house not have a phone?
I guess not. I don't know.
What about the boathouse?
Phones weren't invented in 74. So a friend calls the police, and they show up at the house, and they find the bodies of Ronald, Louise, Mark, John Matthew, Don, and Allison.
And also, I think my family has been shot. Like, if he went home and, like, even saw them a little bit.
Yeah.
That should be obvious.
Yeah. Well, and also, if you walk into your parents' room and you see both of them in bed.
And evening when you haven't heard from them all day.
Yeah. And maybe you see some blood. I mean, I would think you would go check on them to make sure, like, to see if they're okay. And when you get up close, you will probably see what is known as a bullet hole, which indicates that a bullet has entered their body, and typically that means that they were shot with a gun.
Whoa, slow down. You're going a mile a minute.
Sorry. Okay. Let me back up.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
go to work at the car dealership.
So, like, you know, we say it all the time, like, you never know how you're going to react in a situation like that. But that's very suspect, too, to, like... Yeah. Go, like, you went home and you saw what you think were your murdered parents.
Yeah.
And you run to a bar and then just start yelling that you think they've been shot. Like, that is a very
specific,
very unusual reaction. You know, like, I understand maybe running to a neighbor's house because maybe you're so freaked out and overwhelmed you can't be in the house to call the police. And then apparently this guy's an alcoholic anyway, so, like, maybe the bar was his friend's house.
The bar was his friend's house. Also, I'm wondering if maybe he didn't want to be at the house when police showed up, just because he would feel like that incriminated him because he was responsible.
Or it might be harder for him to act innocent.
Yeah. So the police, take Butch in, you know, as like a, I don't know, family of the victim. Mm-hmm. And so he initially tells them that he thought mafia hitman Louis Fellini was responsible due to an old grudge over some work the DeFeos had done for him at the car dealership. He said that he had been up late watching TV because he couldn't sleep and decided to just go to work super early, and that the family was asleep and alive when he left. And so the police are like, holy shit, stay here. Like, we're going to put you in protective custody. We're going to go find this guy.
But I thought he was talking to his friends to work up an alibi.
Well, this was the night before. So his story is the night of the murders, he was up super late because he couldn't sleep. He was watching TV, and he was up until like 4 a.m., 4 or 5 a.m., and was like, you know what, screw it. I'm just going to go to work. It's already the next day.
Well, I mean,
left the house.
Can anyone verify that he was there super early at work?
Well, I think he was only there at like 6 a.m., right?
But I feel like... He left at noon, so people would have gotten to the dealership at some point, and, like, whenever the first person to arrive was there, maybe they were there at 8 a.m., and they walked in, and there's Butch, like, oh, wow, I didn't expect to see you here before we opened. Then also, I thought you said that he went around, after he left work at noon, he went around to his friends to try and establish an alibi. I thought that you meant that, like, he went to go see his friends to, like, say, hey, tell people I was with you last night.
No, he went with them.
He went to see him so that he could have an alibi for that day. Like, I went to work, people saw me at work, and then I saw friends.
Like, the reason I'm just now discovering my parents' dead bodies is because I haven't been home. You can talk to Joey. I was with him, and I told him I was trying to call my parents, and, you know.
It also doesn't seem likely that a hitman's going to try and come and kill people at around 4 in the morning.
It's the best time for taking out hits on people, so... or
no, because some people wake up really early and you like, yeah, some people wake up at 4 and toss and turn a little bit and go back to sleep, sort of. I mean, not that I know what that's like.
Okay, well, we're about to find out how Butch is still not very smart. So the police go to the house.
Oh, I have a lot of issues with his story.
They go to the house to collect evidence, as police do, and they find a recently purchased box for a .35 caliber rifle in Butch's room. Also, there was evidence that pointed to the family being killed much earlier in the morning. They were like, oh, everyone was in bed. Everyone was in their pajamas. Like, when did this guy come over? So they go back to Butch and they're
also they can look at time of death, too.
Yeah.
And be like, you said that you were up all night.
Yeah.
Watching TV.
But
these people were murdered at, like, midnight.
Yeah.
So you should have been up watching TV. Like, how loud did you have the television that you didn't hear gunshots? And if they were coming to kill the entire family, why didn't they come and find you? Like, obviously you were awake and... Sorry,
he has
issues with this.
He has an answer for that. Because they say, you know, they bring all this to him. And so then Butch changes his story and he says, oh no, Fellini showed up in the early hours of the morning while I was watching TV and I answered the door and he put a gun to my head and then dragged me from room to room while he murdered my family.
So it went from, I think it was this guy, to, I know it was this guy.
Because I was there.
For some reason, he wanted a witness to a sextuple homicide.
Yep.
Normally, most people wouldn't want any witnesses. And then he just let me go. And I went into work. And then my friends' houses.
Yep.
And, like, I went about my day normal.
Yeah. And I waited until 6:30 to tell anyone that this happened. So they start picking things apart. And Butch eventually confesses. And he is quoted as saying, once I started, I just couldn't stop.
Once you pop, the fun don't stop.
What is that for?
Pringles.
Okay. That's what I thought, but then I thought maybe a cereal. So the trial was about a year later, and during the trial, Butch's defense attorney argued that he had heard voices in his head telling him to kill his family. And
it's probably the drugs.
Yeah, it was, you know, LSD. The psychiatrist for the defense diagnosed Butch with DID, dissociative identity disorder, and asked for an insanity plea. The psychiatrist for the prosecution proved that actually he didn't have DID. He had antisocial personality disorder. He was very aware of his actions, and he was motivated by narcissism. And on November 21st, 1975, Butch DeFeo was found guilty of 6 counts of second-degree murder and sentenced to 6 consecutive life sentences at the Greenhaven Correctional Facility in Beekman, New York. So my next section was, like, things that didn't make sense, but we kind of went over all those. Couldn't hear, or no one heard anything. Mm-hmm. There's no signs of struggle, no drugs.
Well, and the fact that they were all laying face down, I mean, like, I can understand maybe, like, the younger kids being able to, like, roll them over in their sleep and then shoot them before they had a chance to move.
Yeah.
But then there's also, like, the maybe, you know, if his mother potentially saw him.
Yeah.
He could have, you know, held the gun to her and been, like, you roll know, over. Face on the pillow. I mean, he could have done that with, you know, all of them.
That's true.
I agree it's weird and it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But.
So while he was in prison, Butch did change his story a bunch of times. And there's like...
As narcissists are wont to do.
Lord. There's a whole bunch of different versions where he names Dawn as the killer. And gives himself a bunch of alibis. He says, like, Dawn killed his parents. Dawn killed his dad, and then his mom was upset and killed Dawn, and then he was, I don't know, it something about Dawn killing everyone, and he wrestled the gun and accidentally killed her in the process.
And then he just happened to, like, lay her face down on the bed like all the others.
Yes, and then he went to work. Okay, so that's the first part of the horrible that happened in that house. A year later, December of 1975, this family moved in. This is George and Kathy Lutz.
Oh, he really looks like Grizzly Adams.
And their kids are, Daniel is 9, Christopher is 7, and Missy is 5, in 1975. Oh, yeah. I don't know. His pants are just really high in this. I can't.
Yeah. He looks a little Amish-y.
Yeah.
Also, it's the way his beard is.
He's also kind of hunched over. Mm-hmm. Not good posture. The dog in the picture's name is Harry. Fun fact.
Harry. He's cute.
He is cute. He's a good boy. So George and Kathy, she goes by Kathy. I might call her Kathleen, whatever. They bought the house for $80,000, which I was like, oh, that's so cheap. Cause they thought they were like, oh, it's a bargain. That's the equivalent of $400,000 today.
I was going to say, like, you know, this was many years ago.
That doesn't sound cheap even today. Mm-mm. It's a 5-bedroom house, but good grief.
With a boathouse.
$400,000? That seems every bit. Anyways, okay.
Almost $500,000.
Yes. I did not try to figure out what the mortgage was going to be on that.
We've learned our lesson.
Oh, help me. So George and Kathy were married in the July of that year, to July of 1975. And they both had separate homes, but they wanted to, like, start fresh. And the kids were all Kathy's kids by her previous marriage. So George just is the stepdad. And they they were like, we're going to start a new family or a new whatever.
Chapter.
So while they were looking, their real estate broker told them about the murders that had happened in the house.
And they're legally obligated to.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know when that law went into effect. So maybe at the time they weren't, but I know that, yeah, you're legally obligated to disclose any murders that happened in the house. I don't think, like, natural deaths, I don't think you have to say that, but murders.
I like
to or know. Other violent crimes or something like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, surely natural deaths, you don't have to, because positive someone died in this house. I don't know. I'm not positive. I hope no one did.
I mean, if someone dies of old age in a house, like, oh well.
Not, oh, well.
Well, I mean, like, if you didn't know them and you're buying that house.
Well, yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. I'm just...
Mm. Like, what do I care?
Katie's very... I don't know the word. okay, so George and Kathy both decided that they were fine with these violent murders that had happened.
That's what would, you know, make me like, I don't know about this
If
place.
The house was $400,000... I'd be like, you gotta knock off 100 or something. Like,
see, that would be like my thing.
knock off a couple grand.
Violent murders happened here. Ooh, that's not good. The price tag is $400,000. All right, we're leaving.
Goodbye. We'll go find a house for that price that didn't have a bunch of murders in it. So they also told the kids about it. So, like, everyone knew that this horrible thing had happened, and they bought the house anyways, and they moved in on December 19th, 1975. On January 14th, 1976, 28 days later, they abruptly left and left all of their possessions behind. This is what happened in those 28 days.
Of terror.
Of horror. So a lot of this is from the 1977 book called The Amityville Horror, written by Jay Anson. That was a collaboration between that author and the Lutz family. And there's controversy on that, and I'll get to that, guys. Everyone just... I really hope no one's listening to this being like, oh, it's such a hoax, believing everything. I promise I'm going to get to it. So, on moving day... Oh, this is also going to come... So, it's a compilation of what was written in the book, and then there is a documentary called My Amityville Horror that came out in 2017. Mm-hmm. And it is Danny, the oldest son, who's an adult now... kind of recounting what happened. So on moving day, Kathy, who was Catholic, Kathy the Catholic, she had a priest named Father Ray come over to bless the house. She was like, just to be safe. And he was there for just a really short amount of time, like didn't say hi to, well, I'm sure he said hi, but Danny said, I noticed he was there, and then, like, he was gone very suddenly, and I was very confused, like, why he didn't say hi to any of us, like, we all knew him or whatever.
Maybe he had a whole bunch of other houses to bless.
Well, he later admitted that while he was blessing what would become the sewing room upstairs, which was formerly the bedroom of Mark and John Matthew DeFeo, he heard a deep masculine voice say, "Get out." And he did as he was told and didn't say anything to George or Kathy about it. He was just like, "Okay, bye." Later on the same day, Danny was taking boxes upstairs and he was dropping stuff off in the sewing room, and he describes it as he just went into the room and there were like 400 to 500 flies just swarming in the room. And it's the middle of December in New York. So, yep. You're a local scientist. Can you weigh in on this? Do flies swarm in the winter?
Not that I've ever seen.
No. Great. He says that they would try to kill them. The flies would, like, repeatedly show up while they were there. And they would... He talks about just, like, smashing them, you know, like, mm-hmm. hundreds at a time. And it, like, didn't even make a dent. And he said at this point, his mom kind of began to get an idea of why Father Ray might have left so suddenly. The house was reportedly full of cold spots, which they do say, it's okay, that's not super strange in an older home.
Yeah, it's an older house, and this is back in the 70s. Yeah. I don't remember when you said the house was built, but like
27, I think.
Yeah, so like building materials and everything were not what they are today.
Yeah.
And also this is December in New York, so, you know,
Yes, this is true. I'll
let that one go.
The one thing I did think was interesting is that Danny, even as an adult, could think back and name every part of the house that had a cold spot. And it was like they were always cold. It wasn't just like sometimes it was cold, sometimes it wasn't.
Well, see, that would lend more like there is something about the house that, like, there's a draft coming in through there.
True. Let's see. I have a big bullet point list. Cut this out. There was one instance where the garage door was opening and slamming shut on its own. Reportedly, the whole family saw this, and so George and Danny go down, and they're, like, forcing it closed and lock it, and then they look back at the house, and they both saw what Danny described as a cartoon version of an angry pig with fangs and glowing eyes staring down at them from Missy's bedroom. And I will say this about Danny as an adult talking in this documentary. He's very uncomfortable talking about things. He knows that things sound, like, unbelievable. And he was describing this, and he said, "I don't know how else to describe this other than it looked like a cartoon pig face."
You mean people would find a cartoon pig with, like, demon teeth and glowing eyes difficult to believe? Like, yeah. I bought it hook, line, and sinker right away when you said it. I was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, you know, the cartoon pig that sometimes shows up in your window. So they run upstairs and, like, burst into her room, and they find her sleeping, and then just the rocking chair that's next to the window is just rocking itself back and forth. I love when ghosts use rocking chairs. It's so classic. Danny also recalls a time when he was thrown up the stairs, and then when he got up on, like, the landing, he had no control over his body. And he describes a spirit passing into him and said the feeling was like the numb feeling you get after being shocked, but, like, all over your body. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming maybe if you've been electrocuted. I have not, but, you know. He heard, while this was happening, he heard a voice say in a garbled and cracked tone, "It is you." And Kathy heard it, too, because she was, like, down where Danny had started before mm-hmm. he got thrown up the stairs. And Danny said that he would ask her about it, like, later in life, you know, to be like, "What was that? What did that mean?" And she would always try to play it down, and she told him that it was just the voice of God telling him he'd be okay. Danny was like, "Okay.
Gotta love Catholics."
uh, pressure. She's like, he was saying, it is you who will be okay. Obviously. George allegedly found green slime oozing in all kinds of places in the house, like the walls, the hallways, the attic, etc., and never identified or found the source.
Mold.
Possibly. One day...
If it's a drafty house built in the 20s, then, yeah, like, mold would be a thing. This is true.
They do describe it as, like, bright green, like, jello-like slime. Mm-hmm. But again, this is
ectoplasm.
One of...
Ectoplasm.
Yes. This is one of those things that later they do admit we kind of embellished that part. So it might have been mold, and he was like, there was some green mold here, and the person writing the book was like, you mean green slime oozing from your hallway?
Yeah, a slime mold.
Yeah.
Those are things.
Sure. Disgusting. So one day there was a really terrible stench in the house, and so everyone went around opening all the windows, which, first of all...
In December. Nope.
Yeah, I know, right?
No, indeed.
So Danny goes upstairs into the sewing room, and that window is really hard to open, and he's... Like, he thinks of himself as, like, the man of the house. He was saying he was there to, like, protect his mom. Like, he mm-hmm. was, you know, her oldest son. He was there to, whatever.
Keep an eye on the kids. Help yeah, out yeah, the yeah. adults. How old was he at the time, do you remember?
9.
Oh, wow. So, like, yeah. he wasn't even, like, a teenager thing.
Yeah. So...
Teenager thing.
Teenager thing. I think he was 9. Yeah. So the window's jamming, so he finally gets it up, and he turns around.
Gonna let all the flies back in.
I know, I'm imagining flies swarming around him. So he turns around to say something to his brother, who comes into the room, and while he is standing there with the newly opened window, he has his hands on the windowsill, and the window slams down onto his hands. He said it was, like, skin on skin, mangled, like... just misshapen, swollen. He has one pinky that, like, kind of bows weird.
Skin on skin.
Like, it cut all the way through the bone, and so the okay. top part of the skin...
Okay, that's what I thought you meant, skin was... but, like, did it actually break all of his fingers?
Well, let me finish the story.
Sorry.
Everyone obviously freaks out. Kathy takes him downstairs to the kitchen. George is trying to figure out what the fuck happened. And Kathy is getting ice, because I guess, theoretically, they're going to take him to the hospital. And he's in the kitchen. And this is another one of those times where adult Danny is very uncomfortable talking about it. But he said, a spirit came through the kitchen door. He said, mom's getting ice. He's at the kitchen table. And the door to the kitchen starts to open very slowly. And him and his mom both notice, and they both stop and look at it. And then he said a spirit came into the kitchen, bumped into his mom, which, come on, you're, whatever, and then passed through his hands that are, like, hanging off the table and sits down at the kitchen table. He literally picks up a picture from the house and is like, this is the spot at the table where he sat, or where it sat.
Was it more of, like... It was a feeling of a presence, or did they actually see something?
He said he saw something bump into his mom, pass through his hands, and sit at the table.
Did his mom feel being bumped into? Did
I don't she know, see but she saw it. She saw okay. it, too. And he said he, like, went to look at the ghost or whatever, and, like, in a second, his hands were fine. And so he's, like, describing the injuries to his hands, and he said, the only thing I have left over from this is just this weird, like, his one finger kind of bows out a little bit. I don't know. There's a lot.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
I'll wait.
Okay.
I'll wait. Because I know we're going to get to the picking apart things at the end.
So. Yes, yes, yes. So, Danny also... So he said that he had been possessed, right, when he got thrown up the stairs. And he says that he thinks George also became possessed while they were in the house. George would wake up almost every night at 3:15 a.m., which was around the time of the DeFeo murders. The children all allegedly began sleeping on their stomachs, like in the same position that the DeFeo family had been in. Both George and Kathy reported seeing glowing red eyes looking at them through the windows. George would often wake up to loud noises, like door slamming. One time he described a marching band tuning itself, a radio, etc., but no one else heard these things. So he would, like, wake up and, like, try to find what was making the noise, and no one else heard it. At one point, they allegedly found cloven hoofprints in the snow outside.
The devil's footprints.
I know, I thought of that. I really thought of the lady who had them coming from her... Was it from or to her...
To her window.
Ugh, gross. And then there are some instances of, like, levitation and unexplained marks on bodies. On January 8th, George and Kathy tried a second blessing of the house. That didn't work. And so they tried one again, like, a week later. And... they both have declined giving any details on what happened on the final night in the house because they said it was just too awful for words, but it drove them out of the house and it made them leave all their stuff behind.
So none of them, like, even years later, have talked about what happened that last night?
Well, full disclosure, that documentary... called My Amityville Haunting. Mm-hmm. I might have fallen asleep during part of it. which, if you guys don't know, I have not been feeling well because of, you know, stuff. But they don't detail it in the book. They haven't told reporters anything that happened. As far as I know, Danny has not said anything about it because I couldn't find anything on the internet about it. 2 months after the Lutzes moved out, Laura Didio, who is a reporter who was close to the family, she's actually in that documentary, she assembled a group of psychic researchers, including Ed and Lorraine Warren, which, if you guys don't know who they are, I'm sure if you do, you're yelling at me right now, because some people do think that they are frauds. They are, they're in all of the,
They have that Oddity Museum, right?
Yeah, what are all the movies that they're, The Haunting in Connecticut, I keep wanting to say the Amityville Horror, it's not the, the Conjuring movies, there's like four of those. They're played by, whatever, we'll look them up. Everyone knows who they're played by, Vera something or another is Lorraine. So they're part of this, they're very famous, So the whole group stayed the night at the house. Lorraine described feeling an overwhelming force like water pushing against her. She said that there was a lot of evil in the house, obviously. And throughout the night, no one experienced anything paranormal. But Lorraine is a medium. So she was picking up things that were not happening to people actively. But they did set up cameras.
Picking up or making up?
They also set up time-lapsed cameras throughout the house and let them go. And they got a picture. If I can get my phone to recognize me. They captured that picture, which is right next to one of the spots that Danny said was always cold.
It's really creepy.
It is very creepy. it's a picture of a little boy just peeking around the corner. His eyes are white, which is probably just from the,
night vision.
Yeah. But he's not like a shadow. It's not like maybe.
No, it's like a neighbor boy came by to like check things out and then got spotted by the camera.
Yeah. Like there's a legit kid there.
He's corporeal.
He's what?
Corporeal.
What does that word mean?
Physical.
Oh.
Non-corporeal is ghost. Like there's no body.
Word of the day. So obviously people have compared him to,
the youngest boy that was murdered,
John Matthew. And here's a side by side of them together, unless my phone went away. Which I mean, little boys kind of all look the same, but he's got the same little tiny nose as the ghost boy.
No, the ghost boy's nose is narrower and a little pointier, and also the boy on the right, his face is a little bit like more squished and wide. The ghost boy's a little bit more narrow.
That's true. Well, anyways, this is also a painting, I realized. I definitely thought it was a photograph. It's not. It's a painting. So people obviously have speculated that that is John Mark DeFeo, poking his little head around. I think everyone has analyzed the picture and said that it's not faked. Obviously there's speculation that it's just an actual child that was there and, you know, they wanted a picture. I think it's one of the creepier pictures on the internet of a ghost. Yep. Alleged ghost.
Because he's solid and, like, you can see right away, like, you know, a lot of other pictures of, like, hauntings and whatnot, like the Sophie picture from the Myrtle Plantation.
Yes.
You know, a lot of pictures like that, someone will show you a picture and you don't really see it until they point it out for you or unless you know what to be looking for.
Yeah. Or they have to draw, like, the outline of it.
You know, they say, look in this red circle. What do you see? That is, you look at it and you're like, oh, there's a little boy over there.
Yeah, you're like, oh, what's this picture of a little boy?
Yeah, like, is he not supposed to be there? Like, is that what the issue is? Was he up past his bedtime?
Did anyone else, speaking of seeing things in pictures, I'm hoping it wasn't just me that got all these emails that were, like, back in, like, 2002, it would be like, if you look at this picture of the smoke from the World Trade Center, you will see Satan's face. And then someone has drawn, like, a devil face in the... I bought into that shit when I was 12. I was like, Satan's there. Anyways, you can do anything you want to with pictures. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the Warrens really quick, very, very briefly. Ed Warren was a self-professed demonologist, author, lecturer, and paranormal investigator. His wife, Lorraine, was a self-proclaimed clairvoyant, medium, and paranormal investigator. They're very famous because they've been involved in a lot of cases.
The high-profile stuff.
A lot of the cases they've been involved with have turned out to be hoaxes. There's one... the one that I think the first Conjuring movie is based off of, I really wanted to cover that one, and everything I read about it was like, the hoax. And I didn't want to do a whole story and then just be like, but it was all fake.
Yeah. No.
So the critics of them, besides them investigating a lot of cases that have turned out to be hoaxes, where they have gone in and said, this is real, this is demonic. They just don't have any...
Either they're liars or they're just really bad at their jobs.
Yeah, they don't have any evidence. They're claiming a lot of things, like they'll go into a case and say, this is definitely demonic, and then someone will prove that it was just a hoax. This is a quote someone said about them. They have a predetermined conclusion which they adhere to literally and religiously, which means... they're going to go into a case, they're going to believe with all their hearts that it's demonic, and nothing will change their mind, even evidence to the contrary. The person critiquing them also said, they're very, very nice, and they're very genuine people. They really believe this stuff. It's just you can't convince them that it's not paranormal. I was kind of flip-floppy on them as I have met more people and kind of learned more about, like, not necessarily being clairvoyant, but kind of being open to other things. I do believe there are people who are more sensitive to things going on that not everyone is, but I do see a problem if... there's very clear evidence pointing towards something that is happening, and you are just religiously looking right past it at the devil. So, that's them. Lorraine was actually in the documentary, My Amityville Horror, which you can rent for $3.99 on Amazon Prime. Her and Ed have both passed away, by the way. Neither of them are alive. The interesting part of all of this that I thought that I had not heard, I knew about the DeFeo murders, and I knew that there was a lot of criticism about the Lutz's experience in the house. What I didn't know is Danny talked about the family dynamic with George and Kathy. And George was very problematic. George and Danny had a really toxic relationship, like, from the beginning.
Well, you did say earlier that he thought it was his job to protect his mom.
Yes.
And I was like, well, that's standing out to me.
I know, I was trying not to say too much. I was like, just as the oldest son, nothing crazy. Because someone asked him in the documentary, they said, did your mom ever protect you or try to protect you from George? And he said, without skipping a beat, absolutely no. Why would she do that? It was my job to protect her from him. When George married Kathy, he actually talked to her ex-husband and, like, basically insisted on adopting all the children legally and making them all take his last name, which is really kind of, like, possessive, mm-hmm. if you think about it.
You don't have to think about it. It's pretty obvious. It's pretty on the surface. It's,
yeah. According to Danny, which, again, Danny was young when all this happened, but he believes all of this very strongly. He said that George was really interested in the occult, and he had all these kind of... He described them as, like, weird books in his house, which the reporter rightfully pointed out, well, I might have some books on, you know, some weird topics. That doesn't mean that I practice those things. Danny repeatedly asserts that George had zero parenting skills whatsoever. Family members knew that George was really domineering and controlling. They said you could kind of tell that the kids acted different in front of him because it was like anything could kind of set him off. Mm-hmm. And then while they were living in the house, Kathy always said that she had a feeling of just like peace and calm. And meanwhile, George could never get warm. And he grew more and more aggressive the longer he was there. So the theory with that is that whatever was in the house, be it spirits or just energy, possibly that was there when Butch DeFeo murdered his family, or possibly caused by him and that violence, because none of the other families who have lived in that house since then have ever experienced anything. And they're saying, well, maybe someone like George Lutz never lived there after that, because when you have that kind of fragile, violent personality anyways, that could kind of trigger or provoke that energy and it could attach to him.
So that's what I was kind of thinking of too. Like, you know, there was Butch and maybe he was hearing things and maybe he was more or less possessed, mm-hmm. whether like literally possessed or, encouraged possessed.
Right.
To murder his family.
Right.
Because he's got that negative energy of his own, and it kind of fueled the energy fire of the house.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of was like a catalyst. And so, like, it sounds like George's short fuse and bad temper and everything would also have been a type of, you know, catalyst or, like, just more kindling on the fire.
It, like, thrives off of toxic masculinity.
Yeah, and so, like, the stronger, like, it feeds off of him, and the stronger it gets, it emboldens him and makes him worse, and it's just a back and forth.
Yeah. And then I didn't have this in my notes, but the reporter in the documentary asked Danny, she said, I know people have asked you before, like, you're very young, are you sure that all of this really happened, and you're not just remembering it wrong, or it was like a really vivid dream and you have just replayed it so much in your head that it's become like a memory? Mm-hmm. And he said, absolutely not. I'm positive these things happened. But he also said something that I thought was really interesting is someone asked, do you think of yourself as the Amityville guy? And he said, yeah, that's who I am. He said, but I'm Daniel. And you're always going to be talking to Daniel because Daniel's here to protect Danny, who's the little boy that I was before all this started. And that made me think, do you have DID? Because that sounds a lot like...
That's a really weird way to explain something.
It was. And honestly, if I hadn't been following that DID TikTok account that has taught me so much, I wouldn't think about that. But one of the things that that system talks about, that system being the DID system, is there are trauma holders. Like, it develops from deep childhood trauma, and it's a defense mechanism, and there are trauma holders, and their job is to hold on to the trauma, and then there's other personalities that break off of it who are there to live normal life in front for everyone else, and they don't have to deal with all of that trauma that they experienced. So part of me was like, well, shit, did he just experience... I mean, he experienced something traumatic. Whether it was paranormal... It sounds like
life with George was traumatic.
Yeah. So it's like, whether it was paranormal or whether it was just living with this incredibly toxic male figure who uprooted your entire family twice in a month, like 2 months. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So...
Write that down for the therapist when we have her on.
Well, also, one of my thoughts, too, is like, you know, yeah, he was, you know, young. Like, he was old enough that if this all happened, he could and would and, you know, most likely remember it all.
Right.
But it could also be, too, that maybe some things happened.
Yeah.
And things were explained to him by, like, his parents.
Yeah.
Or maybe he, like, you know, because still, like, didn't fully understand what was happening or yeah. whatever. And you said that they worked with this journalist to put this book.
Mm-hmm.
And so it could have been something like the family just kind of kept talking about it. And you know how,
yeah.
in, like, the game of telephone, like, every time it gets told, mm-hmm. something gets a little bit different. A yep. lot of times it's things get left out, but a lot of times things get...
added.
Yeah, embellished yeah. and everything. And it could be that... the more this story was told as if it was real,
yeah.
the more cemented in his mind that it was real.
Yeah, became. Yeah. And there was some kind of statistic about, like, every time you remember a story, you remember it slightly different than it actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more you dwell on it, the more times you're remembering it. Yeah, the more you change it. And so if it's something you've been thinking about since you were 9 years old and now you're 45... yeah, it's going to seem really real, and maybe the small fly infestation you had in your playroom upstairs has now in your head turned into swarms and swarms of flies. Well, I don't know. I'm going to get into the hoax theory really quick. Not the hoax theory, but the you know, the stuff.
The reasonings.
The reasonings. So, Father Ray, the Catholic priest who just fucked the hell out of the house on day one.
Noped out of there.
Yeah, noped. Thank you. Yeeted out of the house? Is that... No?
No.
All right.
No, we're going to go with noped.
Noped. Okay.
He noped out of there. He had to nope and call the Pope.
So, he allegedly told a researcher that he never saw anything in the house and, like... His only dealings with the Lutzes was over the phone. I mean, that's very different than the story that Danny says of, you were at my house that day. So.
I mean, it could be that the priest, you know, was there and maybe he didn't see anything, but.
He didn't see anything, but he heard something.
Or that's right, maybe he didn't hear anything, but he wants to distance himself from yeah. the story or something. Like, maybe it's. Like, oh, no, it was just, we were over the phone or yeah. whatever.
The hoof prints that they allegedly saw in the snow, weather reports show that there was no snow that day. There was allegedly a lot of damage to doors and locks in the house, but the original hardware of the home was intact and in good shape. They also, in the book, I guess, called the police a lot during the 28 days that they were there, but police were never actually called. Which, to me, these are all just, like, embellishments from the book that... whatever. Eyewitness and forensic evidence refuted several claims. What is that part for? I just read a line that I think I left in by accident. Cut that part out. So, Butch DeFeo's lawyer... So, George and Kathy went to Butch's lawyer to because they saw similarities in there's something evil and negative in this house, and this guy who lived in this house his whole life murdered his whole family. Is there something there? Tell us what you think about his, like, brain or whatever. And the lawyer admitted that he conspired with the Lutz family, quote, over many bottles of wine to come up with a haunting story. The Lutzes did get, I think it was like, eventually they ended up with like $300,000, not from him, from the other guy who actually wrote the book. And the lawyer was talking with them because he wanted to get DeFeo a new trial. George and Kathy say, we went to him with what actually happened, and he broke out the wine, and as we started drinking, we started, like, kind of embellishing things to come up with what would make a good horror story. So they're still saying it's based in something that actually happened. Yes, parts of the book are embellished, but what like, the base of it, I don't know.
Yeah, you've lost all credibility now.
George did say if we made the whole thing up, we would have come up with a better ending than just leaving and leaving all of our stuff behind.
Or maybe, you know, that having no ending at all is like, we can't even talk about how horrible it was that made us all leave. That just fuels it and makes it even more scary because it's unknown.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's left to your imagination to be like, I wonder what could have gone on that was so bad.
Yeah.
That, and so traumatic that they won't even talk about it.
Yeah.
And so, like, that just, you know, like, that's much more enticing than giving an actual ending and giving a reason for just vanishing. Which is not vanishing, but, like, noping out of there.
Which is funny because when I think of, like, what would it take to make me, like, leave everything in my house behind and, like, go, like, it would not take much. Like, cockroach infestation, gone. Taking the dogs, we're leaving. I don't know, one ghost, a ghost that talks to me. No, if I hear a disembodied voice, out of here. Sorry. I don't know what I would do, but it's not going to take a lot. Finally, remember our episode on The Exorcist?
Mm-hmm.
That book was published in 1973. So demonic possession was kind of a hot topic at the time. And obviously the speculation is they were trying to jump on The Exorcist train and, you know, go with that.
So one of my biggest things with whenever there's like a haunting or an abduction, an alien abduction or something that is suspect or, you know, really lacks evidence or is, you know, there's a lot of reasons that, or a lot of evidence that it would be a hoax.
Yeah.
One of my biggest things is like, why would somebody make this up? I'm not saying that as a defending them. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously I believe it because why would anyone, but no, literally, like, why would someone make this up? Like, what possesses someone, besides obviously demons, to just come up with this haunting story? Like, are you just bored? Like, what's the deal? But then you told me about the lawyer thing, and that actually, for once, answers my question of why would you do this?
Yeah. Well, and also maybe, like, George probably was just, like, mentally ill. And maybe this was a nice excuse because now it's not, George is really, like, aggressive and emotionally and probably physically abusive towards his family. It's the house is haunted.
Yeah, it's a scapegoat.
Yeah.
And it excuses his behavior.
Yeah, exactly.
Not in my book, George. Not in my book.
There was a theory that they were, they wanted to get out of, financial trouble.
That was my other, like, when I ask, why would you make this up?
And
because, like, you buy this expensive house and then you just abandon it 28 days later. Like, what is your plan?
Yeah. Like, well, and the reporter pointed out, she was like, they didn't really have time to get, like, behind on things. They were only there for a month. It's not like you miss, I mean, that's not even enough time. We bought this house and our first mortgage payment wasn't due for like a month and a half. Like, you haven't even made one payment on that house.
Well, and it's, and also, like, I was kind of wondering, too. I'm like, well, you know, like, maybe they bought the house well above their means, like, knowing that they weren't going to stay there. Like, they knew that they were going to just abandon it. And maybe there's some, like, legal loophole thing that they can get out of making payments on the house, you know, like, and abandon or whatever. Yeah. Like, maybe there's a way to, like, buy an expensive house, even though you don't have the money to do it, and then sell it and actually make money. And I don't know. I thought it was part of a scheme.
We should look into that, though.
But
there's some nice houses.
But, like, you kind of can't buy a house that you can't afford. Like, I mean,
not that we know of. We can look.
I just mean, like, first of all, no one can buy a house because no one can afford a house.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I like to say I own
everyone has to get a loan in order to buy a house. But, like, loan officers won't approve loans that are more than, like, your income or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know.
What if, like,
they look at my income and it's nothing, and I'm like, I would like a $6 million loan, please. I would like to buy a mansion now.
They'd be like, 30-year fixed mortgage, please.
Yeah, and they'd be like, no, you cannot afford that.
Yes.
Here, why don't you have a lollipop? And there's a nice selection of cardboard boxes outside. You can take a couple if you'd like and have a box mansion. But
there you go.
That's what you can afford.
Yeah. They're like, why don't you try to Airbnb your spare bedroom and come back to us in a year or so? well, 112 Ocean Avenue, which now is actually 108 Ocean Avenue, they did a little shifting, was last sold in 2017 for $605 million. I'm kidding. $605,000. And I don't have any information on the owner because the internet did not provide that to me.
Well, that's good. The owner deserves their privacy. Just because they own a famous house doesn't mean that...
This is true.
Yeah.
That's all I've got for us. We did pretty good on the time.
Nice.
So, yeah, follow us on Instagram. Go ahead.
I thought that was going to be my cue.
Yes. Follow us on Instagram.
The Tales We Tell podcast.
Follow me on the TikTok.
Hannah_Parch.
Thank you.
PARTSCH.
Yep. Find us on the interwebs at
thetaleswetellpodcast.com.
Thank you. I almost said where you can find the podcast, and I was like, people are listening to it. we haven't actually thanked people in a while. I was just thinking about that. So, just as a friendly reminder, John Brown does our music. Susan Jennings Design does our logos. She was actually very kind because I texted her on Sunday night when I ordered our new business cards and was like, I need you to slightly tweak this design for me. And she did it in like an hour. And Corpse Pixie does our
little cartoons.
Mm-hmm. We haven't shouted her out in a hot minute. So, anyways, thank you guys for listening. Be on the lookout on all of our socials for the upcoming stuff that we're going to be doing for our 1 year. So,
still seems surreal.
I know. Oh, I can't believe we're doing this. Anyways, we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.